Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hi, friends, and welcome to the Papaya Podcast. I'm your hostess, trying her mostest, Sarah Nicole, and each week I'm going to be dishing out some sweetness mixed in with some seeds of wisdom or something like that. So get ready to get inspired, get candid, get real, because we are all in this digital space together. Today's guest is one you will not forget. I want to give a little bit of a content warning before we go any further. We will be talking about sexual assault and be talking about assault in general, along with other types of trauma and healing with eating disorders, suicide ideation, and more. So there is your little content warning. Brittany Piper is an international activist, speaker, and healing coach, cultivating 300 plus programs spanning 10 years in three continents. Her work has been recognized by the U.S. Army, the Clinton Foundation, Cosmopolitan, Elite Daily, and more. She is a rape survivor and a leading national expert and advocate on sexual violence prevention and recovery, speaking to tens of thousands of audience members each year. She is also a forensic neurobiology expert, conducting dozens of trauma-informed trainings and programs with the United States Army and sex crimes detectives annually. Lastly, she is the founder and creator of the Functional Breakthrough Method, a one-on-one coaching and healing program that supports survivors of trauma. Please welcome Brittany to our show. All right. Welcome, Brittany. So I just already did a huge, like a little rundown of, gosh, you have like the most incredible bio ever. Like the amount of things you've done in the last 10 years is just so incredible. And you're just one of those people that's taken such a pain experience and put it into action to help others. Right now is April, it's Sexual Assault Awareness Month. I didn't actually pull up the stat beforehand, but do you know how many have experienced sexual, like what's the stat now in 2021?
Well, currently, I mean, 2021, there's not current statistics out, but I mean,
right.
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on where you look, but I think, you know, depending on country, things like that, but overall speaking, it's usually between 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 women will experience some form of sexual assault. Men at, you know, lesser frequencies, but certainly when you talk about, you know, from the perspective of before even the age of 18, 1 in 6 men will experience some form of sexual violence. And then of course, including, you know, LGBTQ communities, they experience 1 in 4 of LGBTQ community members will experience some form of sexual assault. And so the rates are high, it's prevalent, it's pervasive, it happens. I think in some way we all have a connection to it, whether it's happened to us or someone that we know closely. Yeah, it's a deep rooted issue that just needs to be talked about.
And what I've realized even within that is when we hear the stories and we hear from, you know, survivors of sexual violence, it's just the small amount that choose to talk. Because for so many people, the layers in which it opens, whether it's between family, whether it's friends, just even having to talk about it and re-traumatize, there's a lot of really, really quiet people in this, you know, world that when it comes to their, you know, sexual assaults and their violence or whatever has happened to them. You've been doing this for a while now. How did you get into this work? Obviously, I shared that you are a rape survivor, but that's not kind of just like you went from this to that. There's obviously a lot that's happened in between. And I know for you, a lot of behavior changes and a lot of life changes happened for you stemming from this trauma. Do you want to share a little bit about that?
I always say that in order to share about my experience of sexual assault, I feel like there's the experience of the assault itself, and there's the trauma in that, and then there's the trauma in the aftermath. I think most survivors will agree that sometimes the aftermath of sexual assault is almost more traumatic than the event itself, depending on how people respond, depending on their own traumatic survival responses and their own coping mechanisms and what culture has taught us. And so I always like to give people kind of the full context of my experiences of trauma to fully understand why it is that the aftermath and my journey after sexual assault looks the way that it did. So I was born in 1988 in San Diego, California, a Southern California girl. But when I was born, I was actually taken from my mother by Child Protective Services and put into foster care because there was methamphetamine found in my system. And so, you know, if we talk about things like epigenetics and how we pass on trauma, we pass on stress hormones, you know, ancestral trauma, generational trauma, that for me was very real. You know, I was literally born with like a chemical imbalance. And so I was in foster care for some time with my older brother. My grandparents took us in after some time, and my mom got her life back on track and we were reunited with her. To this day, she's like the most bravest, badass, most wonderful woman. And I love her.
I love that.
But that's kind of where like my story started. And my biological father wasn't really a part of my life. Stepdad was around, but he was always just dad, you know? And so abandonment wasn't really a big thing until I think I was maybe in my 20s. And I kind of recognized that. But I think that for me, my first experience of learning how to cope with trauma and pain was after I lost my brother. So Dominic, my brother that I had mentioned, he actually was killed in a car accident when we were in high school. And I always say anyone who's dealt with like immediate loss, sudden immediate loss, you notice that there's like this void in your life. And a lot of people don't know how to fill that void and they do anything to just not really pay attention to it. And so for me, and I think my family's coping patterns and what they kind of, their survival patterns they passed on to me was, let's just put that stuff in the closet and pretend like it's not there. And for them, they were doing the best that they could, but we didn't really face that pain head on. My parents were back at work within like a week or two. They just, it was too hard to bear. And so my experience of coping started in high school, heavy, heavy alcohol abuse, numbing out, pill dependency, eating disorders started when I was about 17 or 18. And then I went off to school in New York City. And so I was away from my family for the first time. And in high school, I kind of came to be known as the girl with the dead brother. I think, you know, like when you experience like hard shit, like people are like, hey, how are you doing today?
Yeah.
You know? And so I felt after some time that my pain had almost become like a burden. Mm-hmm. And so when I went off to school, I didn't tell my teammates, I didn't tell my community, I didn't go see the therapist. I just kept that stuff hidden, you know, like out of sight, out of mind. But within the first semester of college, I actually ended up in a hospital with alcohol poisoning. And I had a blood alcohol content of a 0.38 and I flatlined at the hospital.
Oh my gosh.
And so that's kind of, you would think that that would be like my wake up call, you know, the doctor said, it's literally a miracle that you're alive. And so I went back home, try to get my life back together. And then after about a year or so, I was out one night with friends. We were just out drinking, dancing, having fun. I was about 20 years old at the time. And when we parted ways at the end of the night, I realized that I left my phone in a friend's purse. And so I ventured out into the middle of the evening. It was like 2 a.m. to get my phone, because what 20-year-old wants to be without their phone, even for a night. I ended up hitting a pothole, pulled into a gas station, which was kind of in a bit of a sketchy area. And there was a man there who helped me change my flat tire. And as a way of saying thank you, I offered him money repeatedly, but he kept insisting that I give him a ride home. And so after some time, I reluctantly let him into my car. And then what happened after that is I was brutally raped and beaten. He sent me on my way. He beat me with the tire iron, but he didn't kill me because I begged for my life. I asked that he not take another child from my parents. And so I think that he spared me out of pity, but it was to the point where I had a dislocated jaw, cartilage torn in my jaw, bruising, lacerations all over my face and body. Went to the hospital. Actually, a friend took me to the hospital after I got home. And after about 3 days, he was finally apprehended. And then after a grueling 2-year trial process, he was sentenced to 60 years. But he had been in and out of the prison system his entire life. And so he really knew how to work the system. Mm-hmm. So our case was postponed or continued 9 times, which means I had to go back in and meet with the attorneys 9 times and go through taped statements, go over depositions, practice being on the witness stand, which meant that 9 times, you know, I had to relive every graphic detail of that night. And I think at the time that was incredibly re-traumatizing, but, you know, I think looking back, there's a reason why I can talk about my story in a way where it doesn't harm me. Because I had a lot of, I mean, it was essentially exposure-based therapy. I was just forced to go through.
Yeah.
You know, so that was really hard. And then when the sentencing came to an end, you know, all throughout that 2-year process, the media and the news were very public about the case. But after the trial came to an end, the news anchors did like a segment and they labeled me as the survivor who refused to be broken. They said, you know, 20 years of covering court trials, we've never seen a rape victim who is this strong, composed, this brave. And what people didn't know is that behind the scenes and behind like the girl that showed up in that trial, who didn't cry, who didn't, you know, who was supposedly strong, beneath all of that, I was really struggling again with alcohol abuse, the pills. I was in a very toxic relationship. I had suicidal ideation. And then I was struggling really bad with eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And 30 days after the sentencing, I actually ended up in a jail cell myself.
Wow.
I was out with my boyfriend who was drinking and driving. And I always say that should give you a good indication of where I was at. You know, at that time in my life, he got pulled over, arrested. And as the police officers went to just pull me out of the car to give me a ride home, in my drunken mind, I had a flashback of the night of my assault and a man violently touching me in a car and I snapped. And so I ended up in a jail cell with 2 counts of battery on an officer with injury, 1 count of resisting arrest, and 1 count of intimidation. I remember my parents were like, we're not going to bail you out because if you don't, you know, if you don't learn how to stop running from all of the mess of life, you're going to kill yourself. And I went in front of the judge 2 days later, and this was kind of like the turning point in my life. She knew who I was, and she just said, we're going to give you a second chance. We're dropping the charges, but you need to learn to live with your pain. You know, she didn't say get past your pain, get over your pain. She said, live with your pain. And so that was back in 2011. So it's been 10 years now. And, you know, my journey since then has been a lot of 10 steps forward, 3 steps back. I think recovery and healing is trial and error, and it's a lifelong thing. You don't just wake up one day and you're fixed and fine.
No.
But that's kind of like the full, very long-winded, full context of my story.
First and foremost, it gives me a lot of just awareness around how a lot of behaviors come to be. I think a lot of times we look at alcoholism and we look at drug addiction and we look at crime and we just see it for what it is at surface level. And then you sit with someone like you and you're like, but how could you go to jail? Like, that doesn't seem fair. You've had all this stuff. And yet there are so many people sitting in prison cells who are just living with trauma. They're living with trauma. And the fact is, I remember sitting with my therapist once, and I have PTSD, and she had said to me, are you ever going to go through actual trauma therapy? I haven't done it yet. I'm going to be fully honest about that. But she said, like, you can't just live as if trauma doesn't exist. It will follow you and it's there with you and you can't go around it. You just can't just keep trying to skirt this. Mm-hmm. Unless you have ever been somebody who understands a trigger, you can't empathize or sympathize or understand any part of that for anybody else as to why they might be violent in a moment, why they might turn to something, why they might fall into something, even when they've broken past a habit, because it is so difficult. And I think that we've really normalized saying the word triggering. And I hate that. My kids came home one day and they were like, oh, this is triggering me. And I was like, don't, because unless you actually know what a trigger is, you can't speak of it like so passively. It's so huge and so real. And it's very different than what I think we often hear of triggering or how it's been kind of minimized to be. Because for, like you said, somebody putting hands on you, even in that quick moment, can change your entire trajectory of how, like, your response. There is so much that trauma has done and tucks away in your brain, and a lot of it being, you know, self-protection. I'm so grateful for our sponsors, not only because they are amazing at helping us produce this show, but also because there are parts of my life that are absolutely important and lovely and help us as a family move forward. Today, I want to talk about Pipette. Pipette is a clean baby and mom care brand with a mission to give every family the best start. Any parent wants what's best for their children, and that includes using only the safest products on their delicate skin. Pipette has quickly become a customer favorite for its ultra-gentle baby lotions, oils, and washes. And right now, you can score 30% off its entire collection of personal care items. Wait till the end of this ad to hear how. I want to talk to you a little bit more about Pipette and this brand, because they were new to me when I had a baby. I had never heard of them before, and I'm so glad I've heard of them now and can share with you. Pipette sets the standards of clean and best performing products. While the FDA bans only 12 potential harmful ingredients in skincare products, Pipette bans more than 2,000, ensuring its products are safe, effective, and use only non-toxic ingredients available. Pipette's products are also EWG verified, vegan, hypoallergenic, sustainable, pediatrician, and dermatologist approved. All of Pipette's products are made with a key ingredient, squalane. When a baby is born, their skin is coated with a creamy substance called the vernix, which provides powerful, natural protection for newborns in the first few hours after birth. The vernix is rich with ultra-hydrating molecule squalane, and it has nourishing, waterproofing effect on baby's skin. That squalane is your baby's built-in moisturizer and is key to keeping skin safe. But after the protective vernix absorbs, your baby's skin needs an extra little bit of love and care, and that's where squalane comes in. I can attest to this. As soon as baby is born, they have the softest, smoothest skin, and within days, you notice it gets dry, it can get peely, and so many products cause our daughter to get rashy, get irritable. And so we have relied on Pipette for quite a while. It is so, so lovely to use. And she has the most beautiful skin. And I mean, who doesn't love a baby's skin? But it is just absolutely perfect and comfortable for her. It's not even about aesthetics. It's about her own comfort. And she's not irritable at all when it comes to her skin anymore. And that just means everything to me. Now about that coupon, you can visit pipettebaby.com and get 30% off with code PAPAYA. That's PIPETTEBABY.com and get 30% off when you enter code PAPAYA. I hope you love it as much as we do, and your little ones as well. Now let's get back to today's show. I have always found that the hardest part about trauma is that you have a hard time trusting your brain ever again. I will never feel fully safe with my brain. I will always feel a little bit on alert because you just don't know when something could happen, which again comes back to what you're doing, which is, you know, working with helping people heal, not through, not like away from pain, but like coping with it, like living with it. Yeah. Doing this work now, what is it like? I don't know. How did you even get into understanding that this is something you wanted to do? Because to me, I guess for me, I would just be like, I want to lean as far away from this experience as humanly possible. And you leaned into it. You leaned into it, and you're doing it to, I'm sure, for your own healing, but for other people's healing as well. You're kind of like, this is what you do, is help people heal. How did you know that that's what you wanted to do?
That's a really great question. And I think speaking to one of the things you just said first is, you know, a lot of the work that I do with my healing clients is people come into my healing program. It's a 3-month program. I work with survivors of trauma. And usually we see the symptoms, like you were mentioning, you know, like alcohol abuse, like all of those symptoms, right, on the outside surface. And what the world teaches us to do, we have this very allopathic mindset where it's just fix the symptoms, never get down to the root cause. And so sure, I stopped drinking, but now I'm like over here doing crazy hardcore drugs. And then I stopped the drugs, but now I'm doing, you know, X, Y, Z. And so I think that rather than symptom substitution and symptom management, instead of looking at people who are dealing with these things like alcohol abuse or violence or whatever and saying, what the hell is wrong with them? We should be saying like, what happened to them to get them to that place? And that for me is like having a trauma-informed mindset and a lens. And really it's just having empathy for the human experience. Like we are all walking around like wounded, you know, wounded warriors, but we haven't normalized the conversations yet. And so, yeah, I what you said was really profound. I thought that was really important. But so the question you asked is, how did I know this is what I wanted to do? I don't really know kind of where that awareness came for me, but it actually started with the sex crimes detective from my case.
Wow.
Yeah. So after the trial and the sentencing came to an end, I ended up in jail and I was like, holy shit, I'm in jail like at the same time as my rapist. And I think that was like a big moment for me. I started to compare him to myself. You know, during the trial, they talked a lot about, you know, his defense team didn't have a whole lot to work with. This was one of those more rare stranger rape cases where it was very black and white, but they did try and use the argument that, you know, he was orphaned at the age of 2. He was raised by an aunt as one of 10 kids. He had poor schooling, mental health issues, physical health issues. But despite all of that, you know, the judge still gave him a stiff sentence. And so I got really curious about that when I was in jail because I saw myself in his shoes a little bit. And as weird as that sounds, and I started getting curious about what about all these people around me, you know, like how much trauma have they experienced? Like what cycles of trauma and abuse and violence are they passing on to other people? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where it started. That's where my curiosity kind of grew within the healing space, not to excuse what he did, but to explain it.
Yeah.
You know? So that's where that started within the healing work. And then when it came to the sexual violence work, after I got out of jail, got my shit together, you know, some would say, the sex crimes detective and the sexual assault nurse examiner from my case, I became very close with both of them. Their names are Laura and Megan. They reached out and asked if I would collaborate with them to teach rape aggression defense courses on college campuses.
Wow.
It's a thing here in the States and they do it on most universities and they had done it for a number of years, but they said, you know, students can't really connect with us, but we feel like they can maybe connect with you. Mm-hmm. Would you come with us and, you know, speak with us? And so that's kind of where the speaking started. And then at the time I just started getting really curious again about like the cultures and the societal structures that we have in place that really perpetuate sexual violence, you know, and like, why is that a thing? Why is it okay? Why do we glamorize and normalize and sensationalize sexual assault? How do we learn about sex? Why do we not know anything about consent? Like, how are we walking into the world so ill-equipped? And so that's when I changed majors. And so for me, my studies, I have a background in women's studies with concentrations in gender-based violence and violence prevention. And so I have a very analytical mind. And so I think it was more so part of my therapeutic journey and healing journey has been just to understand the why behind all of this. Like, why did this have to happen? You know, and I'm of the belief that when there's opposition in life, there's always opportunity. And so I've just been trying to figure out like, what opportunities can I seed? Like what opportunities can I cultivate for other people from my experiences? And that's kind of just been like the driving force all throughout.
I love your perspective is so great. And I love that you have a bit of an analytical mind when it comes to some of this stuff. And, you know, I just want to loop back a little bit. You were talking about, you know, kind of the systems that are in place and a lot of the, you know, victim blaming and shaming is still a very real thing. I feel like we just went through this. I don't know. I know it's Sexual Assault Awareness Month, but also just with having the news in the UK of is it Sarah Everard? Her story, for whatever reason, just kind of blasted through the world with so many women having to finally kind of voice that we've never really felt safe. We just don't in this world. We haven't felt safe for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And stories like yours may be the ones that kind of remind us why we don't feel safe. But the reality is that all of us know what it's like to be in a parking garage,
right,
and be looking over your shoulder.
Yep.
All of us know what it's like to double check all of your locks every single night. Then to have children and bring them into this world and to fear for them in this growing online presence and the predatory, you know, world that it can be. You know, predatory behavior has existed forever. It's never been just with technology. It's existed in classrooms. It's existed in families.
Yep.
It's existed in so many. We've seen it in athleticism. It's everywhere. It's just that technology is a new tool. It's a new access point. And so one of the things that I was kind of like, when I was reading over some of your work, I was really pulled into kind of the parents' guide and the sex talk kind of stuff. The fact that sexual violence research often points to, you know, we're not talking about sex. So how are we learning about sex? And we all know the answer to this. We know that if we're not teaching sex, which I'm in Canada where I am, they've actually pulled the sex education programs from school. Like they're not the same as what they used to be. They're very, very, very bare bones. Hmm. So you kind of have to bring these conversations into home. And it's an uncomfortable thing to do, especially with kids. It's right. uncomfortable to kind of prepare them for potentials that you don't ever want them to be prepared. Like the fact that you have to sit your children down and have a conversation about stuff, or, you know, I've got personal alarms for my kids. Like there's so many layers to like, it's so wrong, but right now we have to deal with this at a surface level.
Yeah.
Right now we need to make sure that you feel safe walking to the school bus, you know, all of these things that just completely just blow your mind. And some of it has to come back to us. You know, I read in your one thing, you know, about abstinence education, purity culture, and the birds and the bees, and how are these methods contributing to higher rates of sexual violence? I want to ask that question. How are they contributing to an increased rate? Because I think as parents, we kind of oftentimes it's just uncomfortable and we don't want our kids, their little sweet minds to be, you know, damaged by any of this. But the fact is they're going to Google it. They're right. going to find new information, and it's not being taught in schools. When I first learned from one of my kids, I'm not going to say who, one of them came to me and basically was way too old to be asking, what is sex? And I was like, wait, what? And they were like, no, but I don't know what it actually is. And I was like, what? And I was like, didn't they tell you that? And they're like, no, they stopped teaching that. And so we very just openly shared what it was. And they were like, okay, like, thank you. Like, that was good. And I was like, any questions, you're so like, welcome to, you know, ask more. And I've since now followed like sex positive families on social media. I'm just trying everything I can, because I didn't realize there was massive gaps in my own parenting, even while trying to be like so open about everything, because I assumed they knew. Assumed way too much. As we have this conversation today, I can't help but reflect on the importance of personal safety and feeling safe. Whether it's a walk around your own neighborhood, running errands, or venturing out on your own, you always want to feel safe. With today's sponsor, Birdie, you can keep doing what you love with an added peace of mind. Before you leave the house, you do your checklist for your phone, your keys, your wallet. It's time to add one more thing before you walk out the door. Birdie is the newest essential addition to your routine. Sometimes it's hard not to worry about the what-ifs of life. What if I don't make it on time? What if I mess up? What if I feel like I'm in danger? If you don't want to worry when it comes to your safety, you need Birdie. But what is Birdie? Well, it's a personal safety alarm designed to be easy to carry and simple to use. When you activate your Birdie with a simple pull, the alarm will emit a loud 130 decibel siren and flashing strobe light to help deter an attack. Unlike pepper spray and other deterrents, Birdie is no danger to you. You can feel confident to use it without the worry. And Birdie goes wherever you do. The alarm comes in multiple colors and has a brass keychain, so you can attach it to your keys or bag. Over 300,000 Birdie alarms have now been sold, and they have thousands of five-star reviews. You can join the flock today for a safer tomorrow. As we work towards ending violence like this, we also can work towards feeling safe as we do. Right now, She's Birdie is offering listeners 15% off with your first purchase when you go to shesbirdie.com/papaya. Go to She's Birdie, spelled S-H-E-S-B.
BIRDIE.com/papaya, and you're going to get 15% off your first purchase. That's shesbirdie.com/papaya. Now let's go back to the show.
I used to care so much about portraying a perfect life and acting like everything was okay when really things were far from it. I was secretly battling anxiety, depression, and an eating disorder. So it was a lot. I'm Victoria Garrick, former Division I athlete, mental health advocate, and host of Real Pod. Every Wednesday, I sit down with celebrities, athletes, entrepreneurs, and more to talk about the inner thoughts and feelings that we're all struggling with. So leave the filters and Facetunes at the door and join me on Real Pod.
So I don't know, maybe we could just touch on that for a minute, where kind of like that intersects where, you know, the education and the like kind of that purity culture has actually led to higher rates of sexual violence.
Yeah, that's a great topic and one that I could talk about for hours. So I'm trying to pick out like the most important points that I want to make here. But I think that we have this notion, you know, especially as, you know, some parents have this notion that the more that we talk about sex, the more that kids are going to have sex. And it's actually the opposite. So what they have found in countries like the Netherlands and Sweden and Denmark is they have a sex education rubric that's called comprehensive sex education. So they start conversations about sex at an age-appropriate time. So like starting in like, you know, at the age of six, they start talking to young people about not intercourse at that time, but things like consent, boundaries, body autonomy, what healthy relationships look like. And then it builds up into, you know, what do boundaries look like in a physical setting? And then it builds up into what does intercourse look like? What does pleasure look like? What do physical cues look like? Mm-hmm. And so what they found is that in all of those countries with this comprehensive sex education, by empowering young people to have the knowledge and the confidence when it comes to making their own decisions, their own healthy decisions about sex, they are having fewer sexual partners. They're waiting until later to start engaging in sex. And there are dramatic decreases in rates of sexual violence. And so again, it's about empowering them with that information. But because, you know, in this country, only, at least in the US, only 24 states require sex education and 70% of those programs are abstinence-based, which means that we're telling people, you know, wait until marriage to have sex, which is all well and good, but it's not, let's be honest, it's not realistic, which also means we're not really even talking about sex. And when we talk about safe sex, we're like, this is how you don't contract STDs. This is how you don't get pregnant. And so we are failing young people. For me, I really want to be talking to younger audiences. My predominant audience is typically college students. But I want to be starting younger. Like I want to be starting in middle school and high school. And there's so much red tape. I've experienced so much red tape having those conversations. And so again, if they're not learning about it through school and they're not really learning about it through mom and dad, because the birds and the bees talk is a conversation that is dying. And I think because like you said, like we just assume that our kids are learning this information, but unfortunately they're not. And so they rely on the culture that they see around them. And when we look at what culture tells us about sex, like the act of sex, when we look at advertising, when we look at movies and TV shows, when we listen to music, I mean, music, just think about the way that we sing about sex, tear it up, hit that, smash that. And when you look at the rhetoric and how we talk about sex, we are doing something violent to an object, hit that, smash that, tear it up. And so,
oh my gosh.
But what
that
we're
just
doing,
blew my mind.
Well, but we're taking the human element out of sex. And so when we dehumanize the act of sex, it always leads to violence, because when it comes to healthy sexual relationships and combating sexual violence, and let's just say basically not raping people, you have to look at someone with empathy. You have to look at them like they're another human being. But if we're just looking at them as objects of pleasure, of course we lack empathy. And then I always say, you know, look back in the history books at instances of dehumanization. We have, you know, the Nazis referred to the Jewish populations as termites and parasites. American Indians were referred to as savages, which are rabid dogs. The three-fifths compromise here in the United States. African Americans during slavery were referred to as three-fifths of a person. The Rwandan genocide, Tutsis were referred to as cockroaches. I mean, we can go on and on and on, but dehumanization, when you put people into these bubbles of just objects, like it always leads to violence. And so, yeah, I'm fired up, obviously, but that's a long conversation. I could say so much more, but yeah, I think that we need to do better within the educational space. I think that parents just don't know. They don't realize that their kids aren't talking about. And actually, I pulled this book out because I thought you might ask this question, but these are some of the books that I have. So I have a little one at home. I have a 10-month-old.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And these are some of the books, obviously. I mean, he's not even, all he's saying is dada.
Oh, damn it.
No, right. I'm like, what the heck,
I'm going to be so mad.
So he can't understand this, but like, these are books that I'll be reading to him, you know, like talking about body boundaries, consent and respect. I have like a guide for parents, you know, body safety education. The author in this is Janine Sanders. She's a wonderful author on teaching about body autonomy and boundaries and consent.
Even recently, I read something online about teaching consent as little as diapering. And I was really encouraged by it because I was like, okay, I'm now, we just narrate to our daughter when we're changing her diaper, like, oh, I'm going to change her diaper now. And we're just letting her know. And it's not like, obviously she's a baby. We have to change her. Like, there's all of that. And it's not to like go too far, but it's to start it being a normal thing.
Yes.
So that it's not suddenly being like, is it okay or not? Like, no, we're just going to start really young, allowing her to understand that autonomy or understand what's happening to her, even as simple as changing her diaper or taking her clothes off to go in the bath. It's so simple for me to make that slight change in our behavior, and what it's going to do for her and her psyche as she moves forward, I think is really important. And because I think we're dealing with entire systems now and so much surface level shit, we've got so much trauma. We've got so many people dealing with their trauma in really traumatic ways.
Yeah.
And it's just building up. So what you're doing, and I think why I love you're saying, actually talking about going into things even younger, is because we don't want to keep just bandaging trauma. Like, we can't just keep continuing systems that aren't working. Mm-hmm. We need to be talking about sex. We need to be talking about, you know, I get that Sarah Everard's story really came out and brought a lot of conversations forward, but simple conversations as much as, have you ever said no to sex and then somebody just convinced you of it? And where does that sit with you?
Yep.
How many people have had sex and they're like, I don't really know if I consented to that. I don't really know that was my, if it wasn't a hell yes, it's not a yes type thing, right? And that is within relationships. That is outside of relationships. This is, you know, these are the conversations that are kind of getting left out a lot of the times, but are still creating traumas for people as time goes on. And as we kind of see these Me Too movements, we see how much like sexual pressure on women has existed in their workplaces. Children just deserve a lot more because they just, now we know what's happening.
Yeah.
We are having these conversations. This is where social media is fantastic because it creates this wide stage for these grand conversations and these big movements. But it doesn't mean anything if we don't change anything.
Right.
It doesn't do anything for us when these systems are still in place. And if the systems are going to be in place and we can't change them right now, what can we do within our own homes, within our own conversations? I mean, these are the things that really make a difference. And, you know, the one thing you kind of touched on as well, being just as support people, we have to change the way that we kind of show up for each other. I think that, it's uncomfortable when somebody tells you about their sexual assault. It's so uncomfortable when somebody brings that information to you in a trusted space. And I know that for you, some people responded not in the right way and potentially from their own experiences.
Right.
If somebody, because one thing that I always try and touch on whenever I do an episode like this is that not everybody is going to be that 1 in 4. Not everybody listening to this is going to be the one with the experience or have children that they're now trying to prepare for the world and, you know, have more healthy sexual conversations with them, or sex positive conversations, I should say. But almost all of us will be the three, will be the ones that that one person will come to. So that is all of us. As a collective, we are all in this experience. Mm-hmm. It's not just the one in four, it's all. Mm-hmm. We need to know how to not create more trauma on trauma. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, but Mental Health Awareness Month, while worthy to celebrate, shouldn't be our focus for just May. It's important to be talking about your mental health all year round. The positive effects of therapy will create lasting change in all areas of your life, your relationships, your career, and your overall happiness. Therapists can help you identify the habits and patterns that might be holding you back and how you can move forward in the right direction. Last year was really rough on everyone. From politics to pandemic, the entire world was affected in some way or another. That continues to be true today. That's why it's time for everyone to turn a corner, to move forward from the things holding us back, and to take the lessons we learned in last year and every day and apply them to our lives from now on. Turn a corner with therapy. The sooner you start, the further you'll go. My year last year was incredibly difficult. For the first time in my life, I experienced depression. I had experienced anxiety multiple times, but depression was new for me. Therapy was something that helped me be able to endure and move forward in a positive direction. So instead of just celebrating a month with mental health awareness, it should be our priority all year round. Let's take the first step with online therapy. I can tell you it works. I wholeheartedly recommend Talkspace for your therapy. You can sign up online and start therapy the same day as you sign up. You can text, video, or send voice message to your licensed therapist. So it's incredibly convenient to have virtual sessions from the comfort of your own home. Talkspace lets you send and receive unlimited messages with your dedicated therapist in this Talkspace platform 24/7. With Talkspace, you set goals with your therapist and they hold you accountable and make sure you're really progressing. Therapy can help you shift your perspective, find the tools to cope in difficult times, and be a guiding light. Talkspace is the number one online therapy platform that has thousands of licensed therapists trained in over 40 specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more. Your therapist can help you set and achieve your goals. Talkspace is affordable. It's a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy. And instead of waiting for an appointment, you can send unlimited messages to your therapist 24/7. Talkspace also has thousands of licensed therapists with years of experience in, like I said, over 40 specialties, including depression, anxiety, substance abuse, trauma, anger management, relationship issues, food and eating, and so much more. It's very secure. Talkspace is secure and private using the latest end-to-end bank-grade encryption technology to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure you use the code PAPAYA to get $100 off your first month and show your support for our show. That's PAPAYA and Talkspace.com. To spell that out, that's TalkSpace.com, code PAPAYA. Now let's get back to our show. So for you, as somebody who's come through it, what do you recommend for those who are kind of going to be those people that are going to hear this news from one of their friends and now need to show up as not just a witness, but a support?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I love that you ended it with the word witness. And so number one, we have to be empathetic witnesses, and then we have to be active allies. So what do I mean by an empathetic witness? So in my experience, I always kind of give, you know, an example just to kind of set the scene here.
Yep.
So in my experience, you know, the night that I was assaulted, as I mentioned, I was brutally beaten. And so I was a bloodied mess. You could tell just by looking at me, obviously, that something had happened. And I returned home that night. My best friend was sleeping on the couch. She had been out with me that night and hysterical, screaming, crying. I woke her up and I told her what had happened. And her response to me was, go to bed, sleep it off. Maybe we'll talk about it in the morning. And so I carried myself upstairs, put myself into bed. And as I was essentially trying to cry myself to sleep, my roommate heard me from across the hall. And so she came across the hall, stood in my doorway, didn't ask me questions, didn't analyze the situation, didn't need a play-by-play of what happened. She just looked at me and she picked me up. She carried me down the stairs, put me in her car, drove me to the hospital, and called my parents on the way. And so I always use those two examples as the difference between sympathy and empathy. So a sympathetic response, which I think is what a lot of us is the kind of the knee-jerk response when we, that we have when it comes to sexual violence, because it's so overwhelming and we don't know what to say. And we feel like there's nothing I can do to change this.
Yeah.
Right. And so we show up by saying, I'm sorry that happened to you, but that's life. Whereas an empathetic response is, I'm sorry that happened to you. How can I help you carry that pain? And how can I make sure that doesn't happen to anyone else? And I say it always happens too, like when I'm traveling and I, you know, pull into an airport and I get up to the rental car counter and they're making small talk and, you know, typing in all of my information. And they're like, what are you doing in town? And I'm like, I'm here for an event and I'm a professional speaker. They always get really excited. And they're like, what do you talk about? And when I say I'm a, you know, I'm a survivor of sexual violence, I talk about sexual violence, immediately you see the wave of sympathy wash over them because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I always say, like, instead of saying, I'm sorry that happened to you, did you want insurance with your car? We should be like, I'm sorry that happened to you. And this might be uncomfortable, but like, how can I make sure that doesn't happen to anyone else? You know, like that's empathy instead of sympathy. So there's sympathy. And then being an active ally means continually showing up, you know? So someone confides in you that they've experienced sexual assault. How do we show up with empathy? How can we be an ally? Number one, when they disclose to you, give them your undivided attention. You know, body language is so important. They say 93% of conversations is actually body language. So that's important. Number two, don't tell them how to feel. Don't tell them how to act. Allow them to make those decisions on their own. Number three, don't ghost or disappear on them because they'll take your absence as proof that they're to blame or that they did something wrong. And the chances are they're probably already blaming themselves in some ways because that's what culture is, you know, has taught us. Number four, don't soapbox them. I think when we don't know what to say, we say things that, you know, it's like the insert foot into mouth moment where we're like, everything happens for a reason, or you'll get over it one day. Please don't.
No.
Yeah. It's the last thing they want to hear. And just keep showing up in small ways. And also don't compare them to other survivors. You know, every survivor walks with trauma in a different way. We all have different neurosystems. We all have different traumatic patterns passed on through epigenetics. We all have different bodies somatically. I mean, we all respond differently. And then lastly, of course, tell them you believe them. Tell them you acknowledge your experience. The last time I checked, we are not sex crimes detectives. This is not Law and Order SVU. We do not need to be analyzing and figuring out what happened. It's our job to just show up and to just be there for support.
Yeah.
So those are probably like my top tips.
No, those are incredible. And I think that that is such a good comparison because I think a lot of times we want to just consume and be there, but not always willing to take that next step of prevention and in like true healing. And just honestly, people just need to be validated. Sometimes like even if it's a really, you know, versus somebody who's been raped versus somebody who's been convinced into sex, those might be a sliding scale. But, you know, I just spoke with someone who was talking about grief and she was like, grief can be, it's accumulation of your own personal experiences. So if that trauma can be huge for one person on one scale and might be, you know, minimized for another, but that's the culmination of their life experiences. This is their grief. This is their thing. So just validate. It gets sort of like that pain is relative and everyone has these individual experiences. So if you have been even touched inappropriately in a bar, which at this point, I feel like every single woman has, every single time I have this conversation, every single woman has, and we've just completely brushed past it because it's quote unquote, I shouldn't say it's not normal. It's common. It's so common, but it's not normal. It's not okay. We need to not normalize shit like that because shit like that's happening all the time. And if they can get away with that, they can get away with more. And it just keeps going.
Right.
But if we minimize each other's experiences, the less and less people will actually show up. Inappropriate texts from your boss, you know, inappropriate touches or all these little things, like they're not little things. They are still trauma. And so if we just, I feel for me now, like I'm very big on minimizing my own experiences. I do it all the time. And then when I hear others, I'm very validating of theirs, but we kind of have to show up for ourselves in that same way, whether you're in it or whether you were, you know, the empathizer and now you're going to be that, you know, active ally to them. The very first thing is just validating that experience.
Absolutely.
We have to.
Yeah.
We really have to. Now, I know I could talk to you forever, but, you know, here's the thing. You have done so much work in this. This is why we could talk about it forever, because there's so much to learn. There's so much to unearth.
A lot to unpack.
But there's a lot of people here listening. They're either a parent and they want to know what the heck to do next. They want to be an active ally, or they freaking need healing. And maybe today was like that cue to do it. Whether it was, you know, we're not going to minimize anything, no matter what your experience was that you might need healing from, and maybe are ready to take those next steps in being an ally and being a parent that, you know, teaches this in a preventative way, or, you know, is looking for that healing. What would you say is the best next steps into diving into what you do and your work? Because I think we kind of a little bit talked about it, but not like fully, this is what you do.
Sure. I do a couple of different things. Mm-hmm. So number one, I think, you know, speaking as you were saying, like from a parent's perspective, number one, just having an understanding of like educating yourself on what consent means, mm-hmm. educating yourself on boundaries, educating yourself on mm-hmm. respect and emotional boundaries and body autonomy and things like using anatomical language when we talk about private parts, you know, and not giving in to like the shame culture of we can't talk about our body parts. So we say pee pee and wee wee, and empowering yourself with the knowledge so that you can empower your children. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of maybe step number one there. And just starting small, I think parents get overwhelmed because you're like, oh my gosh, I've talked to my kids about sex. And you know, the sex conversation doesn't have to come until later. So like if you have little ones at home, kind of like you were saying, just like changing the diaper. I mean, simple, small steps, they matter the most. They really do.
Yeah.
So yeah, just getting educated there. Also, you mentioned this earlier, but we didn't really talk about it much. Social media, the internet, you know, there are perpetrators out there that are taking mm-hmm. advantage, that are grooming, that are targeting mm-hmm. young people. So just keeping an eye on that, learning more about what perpetrators are looking for, how they're accessing our children, and just keeping a mindful, watchful eye. Mm-hmm. When it comes to allyship, I think honoring the story of survivors is really important, but also recognizing that survivors shouldn't have to martyr themselves and tell the world everything and like throw themselves into the fire to be heard. I think mm-hmm. that what it comes down to is like, we shouldn't have to know someone who's experienced sexual assault or experienced it ourselves to care.
Yeah.
Plain and simple. And so that might just come down to having to resensitize ourselves to sexual violence and the plight of survivors, because we've become so normalized to it, because we've become so desensitized to it. That would probably be like my top tip there. And then when it comes to healing, oh man, there's so much I could say there.
What is it that you could do on, because you do work with healing as well. Is there anything like, is there a way that people can kind of come to you?
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting that you say that. So I have a program. It's a 3-month program. It's a healing and purpose program. And so kind of as you asked earlier, you know, how did you figure out this is like what you wanted to do with your life? So what the research has shown is that people who find purpose and meaning in life, they actually have a 10-year difference in life expectancy than people who don't.
Whoa.
And also, as you mentioned, we all deal with either micro, macro traumas. I always say pain is pain, trauma is trauma. And I think especially because my experiences, as some people would say, are like glamorized experiences, or what we call in the mental health space, big T traumas rather than lowercase T traumas. People assume that I've had it harder than others. But there are people who, as you mentioned, like have dealt with sexual harassment, and maybe their mom and dad forgot to pick them up from school when they were in the third grade for like months on end. And so we all carry trauma differently. And because of that, we shouldn't be comparing our trauma to other people's. So my program, we are all walking with pain. We're all walking with trauma. And at the root of that is the fact that we don't know how to walk with it and how to peacefully coexist with it. Mm-hmm. And so in my program, it's called the Functional Breakthrough Method. Functional medicine is getting down to the root cause of things. And so again, it's getting down to the roots of our symptoms, whether it's numbing out in life, whether it's avoiding, whether it's giving up, whether it's engaging in risky or destructive behavior, what I also call self-protective behavior, not self-sabotage. And so the functional breakthrough method, we break through our pain, we work through it when we have those breakdown moments. And so it's a culmination of mental and cognitive, you know, focusing on like neuroplasticity and building up new beliefs and new thought patterns. We focus on emotional resilience and really learning how to live within the body and our nervous system. and how we kind of get stuck in a state of survival and what does that look like when it comes to our nervous system. And then also understanding how the body works. And so the somatics of triggers, like you were mentioning, and you know how those live in our bodies and how they affect us today. And so it's a 3-month program. People work intimately with me one-on-one. We have a full curriculum. So there are workbook pages with exercises. Each week we meet for a Zoom session, just one-on-one. So I am their essentially healing coach and therapist is what I call it. The coaching perspective is looking at a future lens and building out and strategizing a life that supports them in their recovery. Mm-hmm. The therapist lens is looking at the past and understanding how that affects our present today, but also realizing that our past is over and we don't have to still live there.
Yes.
So I have another round of that program starting up at the beginning of May. In a few weeks. So I actually was announcing today that the enrollment was going to open up. So we'll have a enrollment open for the next 2.5 weeks, but I take on 8 people each round just because it's really intimate and really deep work. So that's the functional breakthrough method. That's one way that people can work with me.
You are an absolutely incredible guest and such a great speaker. I just like want to say that to you. You have been a dream to interview on something that is so difficult to talk about, but yet I feel like every day, if we just, you know, I've tried to in my best in the last year, there's so much that we are unpacking and dealing with and doing and wanting to make efforts towards, whether it's, you know, being actively anti-racist, whether we want to, you know, survive this pandemic, whether we want to be a better friend or show up for, you know, other people, or, you know, dealing with things like trauma, which is very real right now. I think a lot of people, especially in this last year, that escape mode doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. We're locked in and we're locked down with our feelings. In Canada, I'm actually physically in a lockdown. We're on a month one right now.
Yeah.
And people are sitting with their feelings for the first time in a really, really long time. And mm-hmm. I think just even putting it as simple as, what is something I can do today? Just one small step of something that would, you know, lend itself into what I want to be tomorrow. Instead of, like you said, a lot of people just get really overwhelmed. It's just like so much. Like, I have to be an ally to this. How, this is so much work to do.
Right.
Very simply, following you on Instagram is a very great start. I've recently started and you have like just a lot of like great information. And just, I just think that that's such a simple way to start. And I'm just going to plug you, but also just like, yeah, like paying attention to those things, that sympathy, that empathy, comparison, and understanding that a little bit as well, being mindful in those conversations or that comment when, you know, a lot of people now are bringing their trauma onto social media, how we respond to it matters. How we, that comment we make is potentially, you know, when people write things, we read them in 30 seconds and it may have taken them 30 years to say it. And I think when we really understand how big trauma is and how quickly we kind of experience it in the media and on social media, it's really important for us to take that pause and to take that, you know, that empathetic witnessing and really channel it into what you said, active allyship. So I just really, really appreciate you. You're doing incredible work and I'm so excited that we got to have this conversation. Tell everyone where they can find you and kind of dive into this work a little bit more.
Well, I just first, before I do that, want to say thank you, you know, and I was really excited when you decided to have this conversation because, you know, as you just said, it can be overwhelming. Like, where the hell do I even start when it comes to this topic? And I think—
Yeah, we didn't plan this podcast. We're just like, okay, let's have this conversation.
Yeah. I think it's just talking about it. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes the conversations, like just bringing those to the forefront and just showcasing them, you know, in a community for people to see, like, for people to be seen and heard, you know, hearing things allows people to be seen and heard and not feel so alone. So thank you. I'm really, really honored to be here. So people can connect with me, as you said, follow me on the gram, The Brit Piper with 2 T's. If you want to learn more about my coaching, my online programs, I'll be starting up retreats again soon. Healing retreats for women. I used to do those pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
It's been a while. I am ready to get in the flesh with people and just hug on people again. All that information is at brittanypiper.com, BrittanyPiper.com.
Amazing. I'm going to add that into the show notes as well. Brittany, thank you so much. And for everyone listening, thank you for even being witness to this conversation. Thank you for taking the time to listen to it. Thank you for, whether you're the 1 in 4 or the 3 in 4, whether you're a witness or a victim, thank you for being here. Thank you for giving this your time and giving this your attention today. I think it's going to make a difference if we can just start working on the systems that are happening and also just starting to look at life and people and trauma and, you know, all of it just through a little bit of a different lens, through a story like this one or through the thousands and millions of others that exist out there in our world. So thank you for your time, and we will see you next week.
Well, friends, thank you so much for tuning in and listening to today's episode. For more information on this episode, check out the show notes or find us on Instagram at The Papaya Podcast. And if you loved what you just listened to or know somebody who would, please share it. Simply screenshot today's episode in the podcast app and share it to your Instagram stories. And don't forget to tag us. Last but not least, if you'd like to lend your personal support to the podcast, take a moment and leave a review on iTunes. We would be oh so grateful. Tune in next week for a fresh new episode of The Papaya Podcast, and we'll see you then.